Hi, and welcome to Detox, Talks the Detox, a podcast where we talk to some of the world's finest leaders about their detox rituals and how they maintain continuity in a world of noise and chaos. How they make sure that the criticism that the world puts on them doesn't affect their insight and they still continue to perform as well as they do. Thanks for tuning in. This is Kunal Sundaramani, and you are listening to Detox, Talks the Detox.
We have Tony Potts on the podcast. Tony is a legend. And when I say legend, I mean it. Emmy winning, television personality, done things in the most unconventional way in so many different spaces. An incredible friend and mentor. Thank you so much for taking out the time to be here.
Thank you for being here and having me. It was, for a second when you started off there, I thought you were introducing somebody else. It's like, wait, holy hell, who is that guy? Wait, I'm interested in that podcast. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Tony, what's your journey been in, like, the most authentic, unfiltered way? Like, what's your journey been like?
My journey has been one word, and the word is go. From an early age, my parents had instilled on us, go. Just go in the world. Even when 6, 7, 8 years old, just go. Like, do stuff, have fun, and learn. And as you learn along the way, whether, you know, you get hit in the head with a branch because you're climbing a tree that you shouldn't be, or whatever it happens to be, understand it, learn from it. As I got older, 12, 13, 14, 15, and also I should add, they also gave us choices early on, which I think a lot of parents do not do. You know, when I wanted something, I remember at 4, I wanted these little blue tennis shoes really, really bad. I mean, this is still stuck in my head, so I'm 50 years later. And they said, oh, okay, well, you can have them, but you can't have this and this. So I had opportunity cost. I didn't know what the word was or the term was at the time, definition, what have you. It started to form in my brain little connections as I got older. I chose the blue shoes, by the way, but I didn't get the other two things. I had to work for them. I ended up mowing the lawn to get them. But where there was a will, there's a way, right? But how this formed my upbringing and also my later years in life and taking risks was there was opportunity cost. So when I was 7, it happened 8, 9, 10, all the time. And then when I became 12, 13, 14, and I had friends who at the age of 13, 14, 15 were starting to experiment with drugs or, you know, drinking beers on a Friday night, whatever it was, I would automatically think, okay, well, wait, if I do that, then I probably can't have this, or these are the dangers thereof. And, you know, when you're an athlete, you're pretty good, and you're a decent student, or whatever it may be, those are the risk of things I worked very hard for that I could indeed lose because of that. So it saved me from one extraordinarily bad car wreck. And one of my friends died. It saved me from a lot of things. And so in addition to having the word go, I had this whole other side that while go sounds like I was hell bent for leather and going 1,000 miles an hour and just doing crazy stuff all the time, it was tempered a little bit by this opportunity cost that had been instilled in me just by rote almost over the years, right? So, and that kind of played itself out when I was 17, 18, 19. My parents were like, okay, go. But if you fall on your butt, you can come home. If you fall on your butt on the same thing the second time, come home, you got to work and you got to pay some bills. And if it's the third time, you're on your own. Like, just, you didn't learn. So that helped me. My North Star, Kunal, was to be in New York on television, on a TV show by the time I was 30, right? So when you have that North Star, what I tell other people is, like, oh, it was easy for you because you had a North Star. I was like, well, not really. Because what I like about a North Star is if you're hanging in the valley and you see the North Star and you put it up there, maybe you don't make the North Star, but halfway up, you're like, oh, because of the altitude and new perspective, you're like, oh, that is another star over there that I would have never seen that kind of fits what I really want to do. So you make that journey. So for me, the go part of it was, yeah, go for it. You know, I played sports. I was very competitive. I knew there was a team aspect to it. And so I was fortunate enough to get there technically in my 31st year in New York on a TV show. Because when you're 30, you're actually in your 31st year. So, and by the way, just because this is my world and I had it for a lot of time, Denzel Washington and I had a conversation about this, about reaching certain milestones. And I happened to interview him on my 40th birthday. I said, well, yeah, now I'm 40. He said, no, you're in your 41st. And we had and started talking about, you know, our paths in life and mine. He came from a Boys and Girls Club, you know, in New York. I wanted to be in New York when I was 30. So we got this whole conversation. I'm like, so I didn't make it when I was 30, did I? And he's like, nope, you did not, son. But it helped propel me. So, and then I'll fast forward to the end. My father passed away about 11 years ago now. An amazing man. A wonderful human being, always had a twinkle of mischief in his eye. When I was a little kid, he would like posit these things that I thought weren't true or maybe might be true. I'm 5, 8, 9, but he made me think always. And I had to prove, like, okay, you're wrong. This is actually what it is. So when my father passed, my sister and I, and my mom all laugh about my father dying, which sounds counterintuitive to somebody passing in your family. But my dad was in Florida actually at the time, my mom and dad, and my dad died at 1:30 a.m. on a Saturday morning, but 10:30 p.m. on a Friday night. So my dad has died on 2 days. So we've joked that he always wanted to make sure that we knew, you know, that he had passed away because he died on 2 separate days, because we celebrated on the day before. My mom celebrates on the day after. But I said to my mom, you want me to come down? And I'll fly down right away. She called me, you know, and told me he passed, and he had suffered from pancreatic cancer. And she said, no, give me 2 days. I said, okay, you know, that makes sense. So my father passed, and so I fly down, I get down on a Monday, and I walk in the house, and I, you know, suddenly realize it washes over me that my dad will never be there to greet me again. He will never be in this house again. I'll never sit to him next to him, you know, in the chair. I'll never, you know, sneak a bowl of cereal with him at 10 o'clock at night when my mom went to sleep, you know. But here's the beautiful thing about what happened to me when I walked in. Shortly after that, my buddy called me, childhood friend, and his father had passed about a year or two earlier. And so he kind of knew my father was, you know, it's a terminal cancer, you know. And so he said, so how is it? How is it walking back and how is it? And I said, remember how my dad always told me to go, like, go, go, go. And then when I was in my, you know, career at Access Hollywood, I'm flying all around the world. I'm in amazing places, doing amazing things with amazing people. And in my travels, I always felt that they were with me because they always told me to go. So I felt I had their blessing, you know, in my heart and in my soul. So I said to my friend Mike, I said, you know what's crazy? He's like, I don't really miss him. And he's like, oh, I get it. I said, yeah, that crafty bastard was so smart that he started that. And so he knew that when he passed, he'd still be with me. That's the whole through line of my life, and all is just go, go, go. Give your blessings. Like, I have two kids now. Give your blessings to them. If they want to try stuff, push them, let them fall, let them fail. The best thing you can do for your kids is to let them fail. If I cannot say that loud enough, that's how I describe that. I mean, so go is the biggest thing in my life. And then people often ask me, you know, one word to describe yourself. And I'm like, sorry, I need two, but I'm insatiably curious. And I have been since I was 3 years old and drove my parents nuts. And I'm still probably driving my mom nuts today.
When you go, 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 at what point, like, I think when you're going straight, it's straightforward. You're just taking the next step and trusting in your feet. But when you need to make turns and you're still keeping up with that momentum, what mental state, like when you have big decisions, things that can weigh on you, what's the mental state? What's, like, what's your self-talk?
Sometimes I think the less you think about something, the better, because you can overanalyze, right? No, and yeah. I mean that, you know, with sincerity and a little bit of, you know, comedy underneath. We can overanalyze stuff into paralysis, right? And think in society, as we grow up, society tends to be this ever encroaching geofence where it tends to come in closer and closer, and it starts to really bind you to a certain extent or corral you in a way that you were once this thoroughbred that ran, you know, willy-nilly all over the damn place and made adjustments on the fly. And now you're kind of stuck and corralled. And, you know, for me, if I have that ability to know I'm always going, it's been in my DNA since I was a little, you know, little dink. I'm predisposed to understand other stuff is coming. When you're a journalist and you're on TV and live TV, stuff is coming at you 1,000 miles an hour from all directions anyway. You know, having a producer with what's called an IFB, which is what you see stuck in people's ears, talking to, like right now, if I was doing a live show on TV, I'd have an IFB in my ear while I'm talking to you, and they'd be telling me stuff or whatever. So I'm used to all of that hitting me at one point. And then I think what it does, for me at least, it keeps me relatively alert. And so I will be able to see things coming. And I'll give you an example. I ended up being asked to race in the Toyota Grand Prix of Long Beach. Not in the actual race where the people know what the hell they're doing, but in the dingbat celebrity side. And I'm extremely super competitive, motorcycles, everything. So when I went to racing school, I had to go for 4 days. The pro said to me, dude, you're really fast, but you have an issue. And I'm like, well, don't talk about my personal life. And I said, well, what is it? And they said, you're only concentrating in front of you. You can't. And you have to look way ahead because it's coming at you so fast. And I'm like, oh, and I just switched on what I do in my normal life. You know, one time I was the fourth, for 3 days in a row, I was the third, fourth, and fourth most Googled person in the world because I was in the middle of a shitstorm of all kinds of stuff. Not because of me, but I was getting exclusives on a world stage. I was on CNN. I was on NBC. I was on Good Morning America. I was all these things. And so I just switched over and I became extraordinarily fast. And I ended up winning the time trials and won, you know, $15,000 for my charity. So that's kind of the long answer to your question. If you understand what's coming, and you know it's always coming. It's like if I go to a, if I buy a ticket to a Lakers game, don't be surprised if I go in and they're playing basketball. I know what it is, right? If I go in and the Lakers are playing hockey. So that's just the mentality. I think once you set up a base of that kind of knowledge from which to spring from, then it makes it easier to handle a lot of things coming at you.
Multitasking. I think like having five things coming at you, one from the right, left, and one from a direction you're not expecting, and then another. When you're in that situation, it kind of tends to get overwhelming. Most people miss with when things get overwhelming, you don't have mental space to evaluate and decide what you want to do next. How do you deal with like things getting overwhelming while multitasking?
So I mentioned my father previous and how he always had this little twinkle in his eye that kind of, you know, spur us on to make us think. When I was in that moment, when I was, you know, the fourth most Googled person in the world, and my life was coming at me at incredible speed, I was talking to my parents, and my dad said to me, son, let me ask you a question. I said, okay, dad, go ahead. He said, you sound like your life is coming at you at like the speed of light or faster. I said, yes. He said, let me ask you a question. If you are going to drive across the country, are you not going to stop at a rest area? You're not going to drive straight through. And I said, you know what? And that visual, my dad was very visual that way. And my dad was not into Buddhism or anything. He was just a straight up dude, kind, inquisitive. He said, take 5 minutes and change your breathing because nothing in life happens if you don't breathe. So you can re-regulate yourself. And I said, you know, dad, for a guy who hasn't studied anything, you're 100% right. And so that's what I would do. You know, we would do the show. We would shoot the show at Access Hollywood from like 11:30 to 1 p.m. West Coast time, because we had to have it all put together and on the satellite to send out to all the stations around the country that would air it, because some stations on the East Coast would air it at 4. So that's 1 o'clock our time and vice versa. So when we got done shooting that, and I would always have something to do after the show, I'd make sure I'd go to my dressing room. I'd light a few candles and I would just lie, you know, flat on my back with my hands crossed across my chest and just breathe and slow down, you know, for 5, 10, maybe sometimes even 15 minutes. And it worked well for me because my brain never stops. So I have to somehow, and by the way, I want to make sure, you know, people understand that just because I made certain decisions and I was able to handle certain things, doesn't mean on occasion I didn't make the wrong choice. I mean, more than once, right? But also you said something I thought was very interesting, Kunal, is when things are coming at you, 5 or 6 things, how do you handle them? When you get in that mindset, you start to recognize what's a priority as it's coming. Right. It's like if you're running down the freeway, you know, in a car and there's a snowstorm coming, right? There's snow, but then there's a big snowball, but then there's a truck over here that's kind of squirrely. You know, are you going to worry about the snowball or the truck? Probably the truck. And as humans, we're so fast, our brains. Really, if we give it the space to operate, they're so fast and can make those decisions. And that's kind of how I've always done it.
I love failure stories. Like something you said beautifully, I think early failure is one of the best gifts we can ever have. I think failure stories is, while in the moment they feel horrible, when you look back, they become the best memories. What were some of those for you?
You ever see the cartoon, like where the cartoon character is so embarrassed or nervous that like perspiration comes flying out of their head? I've had a bunch of those on live TV. So people don't know, when you do live television, you don't start in New York or LA, right? You start in small markets. Why? Because you suck. You're not good. And you're going to make some horrific errors that if you made them in a large market, you'd be fired. And it'd be a hard way to get a job back in those markets again, the large market. So I'm starting out my career. I'm doing sports Monday through Friday, 6 and 11 p.m., you know, on a little CBS station in extreme Northern California. In those markets, you do everything. You shoot, write, edit, produce, you know, throw your clothes on. You do your own wardrobe. You do your own makeup, which for me was horrific because I looked across between a clown and a redwood tree. It was like, oh my, good God. And I go down and they're in a commercial break. They're coming to me out of the break. They go to me and I've got highlights. baseball highlights. And I have 3.5 minutes on the sportscast. And when I get to the last series of baseball highlights, I've got about a minute left in the sportscast. There's a Hall of Fame player for the Philadelphia Phillies. His name is Mike Schmidt. And Mike Schmidt hit a home run in the game. I called him Mike Shit live on the air. What happens in those situations? In my brain, I'm like, oh, shit, did I say shit? What did I say? Oh, my God. But meanwhile, the highlights are still going. So you're gonna fall behind. And you've only got 25 seconds or whatever it is left. So I just moved on from that. But if the camera wasn't on me, obviously, because it was on the highlight. But if you could have seen me, I had sweat just out of my head. So I've always been of the mindset, it's not the mistakes you make. It's how you recover from them. In that instance, I just went on because I knew the guy at home was like probably going, did he say what I thought he already did? And then move on. But other ones that are more egregious on camera or things that happen, you stop and you acknowledge it and then you move on. I've mistaken one person for another live on camera. But what that does is I believe all of us have a tendency in our careers, whatever it is. I mean, even I used to manage a gas station when I was in high school because I could and I was very good at numbers, right? And, you know, I got really comfortable in it. And then one Saturday night, you know, I'm going to go out, meet my girlfriend, close the station up, all this stuff. I forgot to turn off the gas pumps. That's not good because you can get free gas. And so it's like I closed at 9. All of a sudden it's 10:30 and I'm like, holy moly. So I go racing back there. And sure enough, I let him on. But guess who was standing there? The owner of the station waiting for me to come back. And, you know, I freaked out so much because I thought, oh, Lord, this is going to be thousands and thousands. Because there are like 10,000 gallons of gas in those tanks. So I could just see, you know, I was happy when I drove up that, you know, lights were off, but people were, you know, this long line going down the boulevard. But there are all those kinds of things, but they snap you back to reality. I realized like I was getting a little comfortable. So I got back to the straight and narrow and the protocol of what I needed to do. And it happens in life. It's the same thing. You know, I study a lot. I over prep for everything, especially all the interviews I did, you know, a lot of with these A-list stars because they have been asked every question in the book, right? But I want to find one they haven't been asked. So with that, that's what always snaps me back. Those failures are great. Take a measure of yourself. What did I do wrong? What could I do better? And be honest, like really be honest with yourself. And that's always helped me. But yeah, it's failures. You learn so much more from failures than from wins.
What about stress? In situations where stress does get overwhelming, what's your self-talk step by step? Like today, all of a sudden you get a call, Tony, there's a huge fire. We need to solve this. And that stress comes running in, all the perspiration. So what's your self-talk that goes on?
I'll give you two different ways that I respond to stuff. So for stress I know that's coming, or stress that I know, if I'm going to have a couple of months of on the road or shooting stuff or whatever it is or anything, I just make sure I'm in good shape. I'll run, you know, like here, beaches, you know, actually around the corner through this wall. You know, I'll run 1.5 miles and then I'll stop halfway, jump in the ocean, body surf for 30 minutes, which by the way, I thought like, oh my God, the first time I did it, my legs are going to be so tired from body surfing that how am I going to run the last 1.5 miles back? Turns out it's the opposite. It's almost like a cold bath because in, you know, Southern California, the water's not as warm as people think it is. It's not like Florida, you know, or Fiji. I mean, you know, shocker. Getting in shape. I think if you're physically tough and you physically walk in a room a little taller, a little better, you handle your body, your movements, your hand movements are a bit different. Your core is better. That helps. And I've always had an extraordinarily low heart rate, which, you know, scared some doctors when I was really young, which then scared the, you know, bejeebers out of me because they're like, oh, why are they scrambling? But I've always had that. And what is weird is when really, really bad stuff happens. I can remember when I was early on, I was like 14 and I saw a horrific crash in front of me, my mom driving. I didn't freak out. I got out of the car. You know, I went to look for towels. And what happens is my heart rate remains low. For some reason, I don't freak out. I don't know what it is. I would like to claim that I went through something and I have some superpower, but I'm telling you, I'm clueless. But there have been fires. I've been in fires in Malibu. I just think really clearly and I process very well. Now, what drives me bananas is sometimes in just common things of life, I'm an idiot. It's just like, you know, it's like my sister has a very high IQ. I mean, incredibly high IQ. She can actually go to a store, park like right in the front, and she'll walk out of the store and wonder where her car is. She'll like go right and it's like right in front of you. So I don't have that, but I'm a firm believer in life that the yin and the yang balance out everything. If you look at anybody that's massively successful, they've had massive either failures or heartbreak. It just is. So, you know, maybe that's part of my upbringing, but I go into it again, knowing if I buy a ticket to the Lakers, I'm going to watch the Lakers once I get inside, you know, the arena. So I understand that in life every day, stuff's going to happen. It just is. And I don't know why I'm extraordinarily calm in really bad situations. I mean, there's some stuff I've seen that's just been horrific. And but I'm glad for that because, you know, it's like nurses and I've even seen some doctors freak out, but not unsung heroes. I think out of the pandemic, we realized how important, it's always been important, but we've given them more of a due, but still not enough. You know, nurses have it. They're pretty incredible. And so I like because then I can always calm the people around me and hopefully help the situation out.
I think, well, maybe not naturally, but I think that there's like such a huge advantage in like so many situations are not as bad as we think they are, only if we take a good, calm look at them.
I agree with you. And this goes back to the geofencing of society, you know, putting us in a paddock, right? I'll give you an example. So I've emceed a lot of, you know, events around the world on stage, whatever it happens to be. And there was one in LA actually, and it was all about brainwaves and about your thought process, freeing yourself. And it was really interesting. And I thought, you know, yeah, I'll host this because first off, I don't know much about it in a way that they're probably going to teach me. So it's an opportunity for me to learn. And they had said to me that we're going to have this elderly woman come on stage and she's incredible. And I'm like, I was just stoked, right? So when I host something like that, I always go into the green room where all the guests are kept and I just say hi to them and just talk to them a little bit. I never talk to them a lot. I never really ask them questions because I'm not an actor. So I want everything to be authentic when we go out. When I discover something about them, I truly will. And so will the audience, right? So that's kind of a lovely thing. So I'm chatting with her. She's really like just quiet and kind of just, you know, arms crossed. And I'm thinking, I'm leaving going, holy moly, this is like, she's going to be horrible on stage. She can't even like barely talk to me. She gets on stage and she's like, listen, everybody, before we get going, I got to ask you a couple questions. You know, first off, can I have some volunteers? And she gets two adults. And then there's some kids in the audience. She asked this one mom if her 5-year-old son could come up. I'm like, sure, absolutely. So they come up and they put on these noise canceling, you know, soundproof headphones on them. And she tells the audience, okay, I'm going to show you something here. This is how society comes in and restricts your life. And so she goes, I'm going to ask them and tell them that we've all decided that we're all going to go get ice cream, like now. And I want you all, when I raise my hand, to raise your hand. So they'll look like we've all agreed on something. So she raised her hand. I raised my hand. And she takes the headphones off the first adult and says, hey, so look, you just saw the hands go up. We've all decided we're going to go get ice cream. It's just right out the front door. We're going to go. Like, well, I paid to come to see. Well, what kind of ice cream is it? Like, is it lactose? And how far away? Like what? So people kind of snicker, take off this next adults. And the adult was like, but that doesn't make any sense because we're supposed to be here learning something. But, you know, I mean, and she's like, well, what ice cream do you like? Well, I don't know. It depends, you know, back to the lactose intolerant. I can't have certain things. You know, and then how's everybody going to fit in there? And who's paying? And then she takes off the headphones of the 5-year-old kid and goes, did you see us all raise our hands? And the little boy's like, yeah, what did you do? And she said, well, we all decided we're going to go get ice cream. He's like, let's go. So if you see, and that's what, and by the way, the word go is in there. If you notice the pattern here. So I don't say go willy-nilly. I mean, assess your situations in life because sometimes those can be dangerous. But that just was an example to me of, and then she turned to the one lady or the one adult and said, did you learn something? And he said, yeah. She goes, see, you have to open your mind. And I think that's one of the great, you know, you were so correct and we limit ourselves. And look, life's hard. Life's really freaking hard, man. You know, and it's hard anyway, just by nature, it's hard. You got to make dinner and you got to do laundry and you got to pay bills and you got to find time for this and that. And it's like this, you know, blizzard of just cockapoo stuff you got to do all the time, right? But you have to be able to also take a few minutes out for yourself. You know, my parents didn't have much money growing up and my mom stayed home but you know, money was tight, but we made do with certain things. And you know, my sister raised her son as a single mom for a while, you know, and she worked two jobs and went to school, you know, so if you can find that moment, you know, like my dad said, to pull off to your, you know, mental rest area, you know, and take a break and take care of your breathing little by little, it helps.
I love it. Life happens. I think it's, looking at how life happens is we forget that it's not something that happens to you. It is the only thing that you are. Life is what we are. Enjoy every minute, every second.
Yeah. Does it happen at you or does it happen with you?
I think it is you. Life is all we are. So enjoy every second.
I agree. Don't underestimate the power of smiling from within. And I'll give you an example. So when I was at Access Hollywood, after about 2 or 3 years, a lot of the celebrities, their managers and agents realized I was actually not a ding dong. And I was actually they perceived me as a smart guy who actually, who gave a crap and really did research and cared. You know, it's like anything else in life, any profession, you're going to find those who aren't good. Those who are mediocre and they live there. And then you're going to find the few that just really give a lot and really want to, they just really care. They find innovative ways to do things. And so I really cared. I mean, since I was a little kid, I used to run. I was fortunate enough that I was able to read pretty easily by the time I was four. Like I could read when I was three, but like four and a half, five pretty easily. I mean, you're brilliant, but it wasn't that way. But I could also do my times tables to 10. So when I was four, I used to hear the bus come to drop kids off in the afternoon. I used to run down with a pencil and a little notepad to ask them about their day, which was, I guess, okay for the first 2 days. And then the days after that, they started beating me up, throwing me in the bushes. And I'd come home with with straw and grass in my hair. And I was like, I don't think you should do that anymore. I've always been, very inquisitive. And so when I started interviewing a lot of very famous people, they started to trust me. And, trust in Hollywood are mutually exclusive, usually, right? There are some of the celebrities who weren't so good in front of the camera or got really nervous and what have you. So I would coach them. And, I would say to them, look, if you're going to go on live television, just bring a little piece of paper with you. And before you go out, just put a smiley face on there, okay? And the word slow. Slow meaning you're going to talk much faster when you're on live television because it goes by like we were talking earlier. 4 minutes is like a minute, right? But they said, well, what's the smile for? I said, because look at you. You're on national, international, whatever it is, television. And at some point you were a lost 10-year-old figuring out what you want to do with your life. And you're doing what you really want to do. Like, holy moly, man, this is great. So smile from within, because what people don't realize is when people see you on television and you're smiling from within, there is an energy that is emitted and people will somehow like you. They're not really sure why. I mean, as long as you're not, this crazy person on, but all things being equal, they will find like, I could have a beer with that person or a cup of coffee or what have you. And once you have that, you're in, right? You're in. And so I teach a lot of people that's the way, I think, to help steel your nerves, but also give yourself a pat in the back. Like, man, like people want to talk to you and you're on national and they're giving you 4 minutes or 5 minutes of free time. Right. So that's what I do when I coach people, because it's really important to understand that dynamic and understand the power of energy. While I think we're kind of getting there in society, you must think about, we have cell phones, right? Cellular energy. It's always been here, but we just didn't know about it, how to capture it. Imagine how many other wavelengths there are in the world that we don't even know about, right? So it's just that kind of stuff,
If I can see the smile within.
Yeah. I'm always, look, I'm happy that you and I met, as random as it was, and, with my wife and all that good stuff. And, hearing, when I first met you, I had a lot of questions, because your journey and your story is incredible. And it will continue to be so. You have perspective and knowledge that I never had. My Achilles heel is my brain is exceptionally fast. So I can get to something pretty quickly, but a lot of times it's on a highway going 1,000 miles an hour where, and I'm not going to speak for you, but the ability to curate knowledge and then go deep, not just wide, is something that I admire about you, right? When I do decide to go deep, which my professors always told me, I can do quite well, but I get bored exceptionally easy and I want to move to the next. Even if it's with the person I've interviewed 50 times, I'm not bored by them because I probably researched something about them recently that most people don't know that I can bring up that will make them feel good, right? And so there's always a new way, angle, and I'll give you an example. This is kind of the same, but different. So when you're doing a show as big as Access Hollywood, we were kind of this number two show because Entertainment Tonight had been around forever and they were the worldwide behemoth and all that good stuff, right? And so we all kind of do the same stories, right? Like if there's a big movie with, you know, Denzel or Harry Styles is in the Christopher whatchamacallit movie, you know, we're all interviewing them. And then when we do the award shows, the Oscars or what have you, we're all on the red carpet asking the same stupid stuff sometimes, right? But for me, I was like, I don't want to do that. Let's find something different. So we had a meeting about the Golden Globes. And at the Golden Globes Awards, they're kind of a looser. I mean, when you walk on the red carpet, they give you champagne. I mean, the minute out of your car, your driver's door, they give you, hand you a champagne. So by the time an hour later, the festivities start, when you get to your table, by the way, there's champagne beyond belief. But we get to have the big shows have platforms like us, Entertainment Tonight, what have you. So we thought in a meeting, it's like, well, it's back to the 62 degrees in LA and people wear scarves thing. It was going to be chilly on a Sunday. And we thought, okay, how about we put a cappuccino bar on our little spot? And so people will come and spend more time, which is important, because they want to get warm, right? So we decided that. We talked about it. I gave some ideas. Others gave ideas. So we make it happen, right? So there's this great actor named Nathan Lane. He's also done Broadway. He's won. I mean, he's all kinds of great stuff. And we knew he was going to show up. So he shows up. I'm chatting with him. We're doing a little chat. He's going to get a cappuccino. And then somebody else comes up. I don't know if it was maybe Nicole Kidman or somebody, or maybe it was Nicole Kidman. And so I start talking to her, and he stays at the bar. And then I look over 2 minutes later, and there's Ludacris, the rapper, hanging with Nathan Lane, just chatting about life, drinking cappuccinos, right? So nobody else had that at all. And that went viral. And that's, you know, in this day and age of content, and everybody always says content is king. And I'm like, nope, content that is seen is king, right? And it's always been about storytelling since we were putting, you know, stories on cave walls. A good story is a good story is a good story, but you got to find your point of difference. So that's what I loved about all of that stuff is just, you know, finding the unique moment, not being scared that, you know, if it falls flat on its face, doesn't work, you know, we could have had something happened up on the platform where somebody burned themselves or whatever, but you got to take your chances. And so that gives me great joy.
I love that. I absolutely love that unconventional nature. What about trenches? Any really rough patches in life that ended up becoming your favorite memory?
Well, so my second job was doing sports in the Northeast. So I'm 20 something, I don't know, 24 maybe. And my first job, I made no money. Basically, I had my first job on television before I graduated college. So I was doing Monday through Friday, you know, 6 and 11 p.m. sports for CBS while I was still in college. Graduated, and then my goal was obviously to be in New York. So I got an offer to join this station. It doubled my pay, but don't go crazy. My pay was $9,800 a year, and it went to $19,600 a year. But it was an opportunity to move up, right? Bigger market. It was a brand new station. And it was bought and run by the richest Irishman in North America named Thomas Flatley, made his money in hotels. So I'm there about 9 months and things are going well. There's about 60 people who changed their lives and came to that station, you know, in the last year. And so I remember it was April 1st, April Fool's Day, and opening day in baseball was just around the corner. This was in New Hampshire. So I went down 50 miles, whatever it was, to Boston to talk to the Red Sox about, you know, the upcoming opening day. I get back at 4:30 and I got to write and put this package together really quickly. But I walk in because we have a 6 o'clock newscast. And so I walk in and there's nobody in the newsroom, not a single person. Never happens in news. And so I was like, where is everybody? And I look at the janitor and I said, hey, he just pointed up the stairs. So I went up the stairs, and as I'm coming up the stairs, canal, I can see into a conference room and everybody's in there. And I hear like some sniffles, like people crying. I'm like, well, this can't be good. And as I get up the stairs, I turn to the right, I walk in the door, lean against the door. I hear the owner, Thomas Flatley, say, this hurts me as much as when I put my dog to sleep. I'm thinking, oh, good Lord. So I said, hey, sorry, just came back from a story. What's happening? And he said, we're shutting down the station. I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. When? Now. I'm like, now? And mind you, it's April Fool's Day. And I'm thinking, is this cruel? Not cruel. What is this? And I said to him, well, to those of us who have contracts, will you honor them? Because I wanted to get him on the record. And he said, yes. So suddenly I'm out of a job. Like, out of a job. I still got paid. He ended up not paying us fully. We had to go to court. So I went down. I said, excuse me, I need to go down and make resume tapes. So this is in the late 80s. And so I made 125 resume tapes. And I researched, you know, all the TV stations. So think about the United States from right to left, right? Northeast all the way down through like whatever, Alabama, all those places, Texas, you know, all the way back up through California up to Seattle, where I was from. I was going to make a U-shaped pilgrimage on the way home. So I sent all these resume tapes and letters out ahead of time and said, you know, look, I'm going to be, you know, at your station at 2 o'clock on this day, by the way, you know, using a map, not anything on a phone. And then I had to go, no cell phone. So I would have to go to the phone booth in some ho-dunk place and call the station I was going to meet the next day. So I would go, long story short, I end up back in Seattle. And it took me about 2 weeks to get across the country. So I'm back in Seattle. About 2 weeks after that, the rejection letters start coming. One after another, after another, after. I get almost 100 rejection letters. Now, so talk about being in the trenches and being down. But there are a couple of them that say, maybe you're not made for television. Maybe you ought to think of something else. And I was like, what? Now, luckily, I was young enough to just get pissed off. But it did kind of hit me like, ooh. Maybe, and nobody else actually gave me a job, right? So momentarily, I was rocked for probably about 4 or 5 days. But that's where youth and naivete come in, because it's like, you know, who are you? And the saving grace to all of that is my dad took me aside when I was in eighth grade, because a lot of my friends started to leave me because I wouldn't do drugs and what have you, and drink or whatever. And my dad said to me, he said, listen, they're being mean to you out of fear. And they're being mean to you. It's because of them. It's not because of you. You don't know what's going on in their life. He goes, look, if they, you know, physically come at you, then take care of them, you know, fight back. But, and so that hit me when I got those letters and the one saying, you know, you should maybe try another line of work. Maybe they're having a bad day. Maybe they're in a really crappy market and they hate their lives and they hate, you know, running a news station. Who knows, right? And I think that that's a lesson in life that I was lucky to have, because I can't tell you how many people I've met in the years since where people get thrown, really good, wonderful human beings get thrown by some idiot who says something, and they're probably miserable human beings. So, you know, so that helped me at that moment. And I just decided in Seattle, I'm going to call every TV station and just ask them if I can come in and edit a new resume tape, and I'll pay them $20, you know, whatever it was to do that. And I thought, but once I get in, I'm going to talk to the news director. And long story short, news director came by one day when I'm editing in their things. And I said, oh, do I got to go? He's like, no, what are you doing? I'm like, oh, this is it. And he's like, oh, we, you know, we have a temporary opening. You want to come in and do a couple of shows? I'm like, sure. And that with it, I said, look, I will work for you for a week for free. Oh, no, we can't do that because they were union. But I said, I will. Or I'll work for you wherever the rate is. And if you don't hire me, I'll give you the money back. I said, no matter what, I wanted to work. And it was the only time really in my life I'd ever been out of work, because I'd been working since I was 15. And so that happened. I got on. And then from there, I just went to Providence, Rhode Island, from Providence, Rhode Island to New York City to, you know, to LA. I got a deal with Disney and ABC to do my own late night talk show. And they hired some guy named Jimmy Kimmel. I don't know whatever happened to him, but, you know. I hope he's okay. So that's something where I think a lot of life lessons, you know, people can relate to. The main thing is, it's three words I'll tell people. When stuff like that comes at you, consider the source. It'll take a lot of weight off you, save you a lot of suffering, a lot of guilt, a lot of pain. You know, and by the way, it doesn't mean that I still don't get rocked once in a while, right? And then also too, I've had opportunities where people said stuff and I look at everything. My wife gets mad at me sometimes because she says, you're the most stirred person out there. I'll see both sides of something. And sometimes you have to realize, at least with me in my life, that sometimes my wife just wants me to listen and not have an opinion and draw the fair things. But there have been times in my life where maybe I should have listened a little bit more to people when they said something. But I think on par, I've probably benefited 90% of the time of considering the source of whatever negativity is coming at me.
That is so beautiful.
Oh, thanks.
Like, I love
it, man. Like, I, you know, it's true. That's the thing. It's like, it's not me. It's just, it's what it is. And what I learned from really, you know, really tough situations.
I think humility is one of those things. I think once you've rocked the boat enough times, humility just comes naturally after a bunch of times of just really being on the edge. And it's kind of beautiful when it comes in, because it puts you in a place to really appreciate all the things that went right.
I agree. Absolutely. It's one of those things where when I started the venture capital fund, I would see these young guys come in pitching, right? And, or I'd go to like Graycroft and those guys and just watch their pitch, you know, guys pitch to them and stuff. And by the way, I have a whole opinion on the Graycrofts and the VCs of the world, but we'll get into that at some other point. But I would see these, you know, young guys come in and they'd have some success in their startup. And it's what we kind of call in the business cock of the walk, you know, just like their feathers are all out and they're like, woohoo, you know, they'd be assholes, they'd be dicks. And so I would say to them afterwards, I'm like, look, you're doing well now, but here's one thing I will tell you. And this is a universal truth. And if you don't, you know, if you don't want to listen, that's fine. But you're going to get knocked on your ass at some point. And it's going to be hard. It's going to be freaking hard, brother. And so you better understand that when you're on your way down, you're going to pass the same people that you screwed. You're shitty to. And they're not going to have the time of day, because it's going to happen to everybody. I mean, if Steve Jobs can build Apple and then get his ass kicked and thrown out, who are you? Like, honestly, right? I mean, even if you go through the history of great people, it's happened to all of them. So, and it's usually in your 20s, you think your shit doesn't stink and nobody can touch you. But at some point you'll get slapped upside the head. You'll be like, oh. The difference between those who become, at least the ones I've met that become absolutely great, is it takes them back to reality. They actually listen. They actually take in what happened. How did it happen? What was the path that got me here? And then they tear themselves down and then rebuild themselves in a way that A, takes all the great things that they had that got them there, and then a couple of gnarly things that, you know, screwed them over. So.
Absolutely. Moving to the rapid fire round, couple quick questions, answer them in the least possible time. One piece of advice that is thrown around very often, but you don't agree with.
Slow down in your 20s, man. Figure it out. Have some fun. Screw up. You know, make mistakes. Learn, live. The serious shit's coming. Your 30s, 40s.
One piece of advice that people don't say as often or do not believe to be true, but you really think it is.
You are enough. People look externally for validation, whether it's religion or whatever. And if that's great for you, I'm not saying one way or the other, but you are enough. Because what you manifest as religion to need for you is coming from you, and you've created that already.
Absolutely. You are. You can be your own temple and you can be your own universe. Just look in. Your favorite beach?
There is a somewhat hidden beach in Maui, down past a head, rock head that comes out, that you park in what looks like not even a place to park, and you gotta look through gotta almost like thatch yourself through a jungle to find a little path. And when you walk out, it just opens up and it's white sand, turquoise waters, nobody's there at all. And the great thing is when you go back out, by the time you go back out, across the street is a food truck with some of the best fish tacos you'll ever have in your life, made with fresh coconuts.
Your favorite city in the world?
Well, that's not fair, because I love Barcelona, because it is wide avenues, boulevards. The art is incredible, from Gaudi to everybody. The mentality of the Catalonians, especially in that region, is very welcoming. They work to live and we live to work. And I love that about them there. But like for business, I love New York. I love London because New York's in your face. London is incredible because it is kind of the center of everything, if you really think about it. I know New York says that, but, and then Paris, because it's the city of light, you know, and I'm a romantic at heart. So by the way, there's one other thing I should say real quick. My dad gave me this advice, and I also heard it on the radio one day, and I nearly crashed on the 405, which is remarkable because you only go 10 miles an hour on the 405 freeway here in Los Angeles because you can't go 65. So it would have been a minor fender bender, but someone on public radio had said what my dad had said to me years ago, and I forgot. Don't bleach red flags white, because pink is pretty, but it's poisonous. And what I mean by that is if you bleach the red flags white, they usually turn to pink. I have tried to bleach a number of red flags white, and I should not have. If you look back, anybody listening, if you look back in your life when you've made mistakes, especially if it's in a relationship or what have you, if you honestly look back, there were a shit ton of red flags. But because you're in the fuzzy, wuzzy, oh, I love it, whatever, in fact, whatever, you kind of go, eh. But then when you you know, truth comes to bear later on, if you get married or get serious relationship, you can't bleach the red flags white. You cannot. They have to take them out themselves.
That is beautiful, scary. That is so, I said beautiful and it just hit to me. That is not beautiful, that is scary.
No, it's beauty. It's beautiful in its simplicity to understand. It's horrifying in the fact that it's hard to enact.
It's simple, not easy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I love that line. It's simple, not easy. That's what most things in life are. They're simple. They're very simple. Like waking up at 5 a.m. is simple. It's not easy. Like reading a book, reading a couple pages a day is very simple. Making a good investment is very simple. It's just not easy. Okay, your favorite activity to do?
Basketball.
Your second favorite activity?
Body surfing.
Your favorite movie?
Get Him to the Greek.
Your favorite song?
Is Black by Eddie Vedder and Pearl Jam.
One piece of advice someone gave you any time in your life that just keeps flashing back?
My dad saying, consider the source.
Advice is most times tailored to somebody, but without knowing the person on the other end, just some random person with any random number of variables. And if you could tell them a couple words, what would those be?
That's hard because it's situational and it's vibrational. I'm indigenous, so I have Cherokee and Cree in me. And so I can feel some things sometimes. So I'm a pretty good at gauging somebody's energy pretty quickly. Just be you and you are enough.
I love that.
You just heard an episode on the Detox Podcast. Do not forget to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform, whether it is Spotify or iTunes. We are there.